this is your Polycast for Wednesday, May 25th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, Minneapolis schools pick a new leader, and a window closes on sex abuse lawsuits. Governor Mark Dayton said yesterday he still hasn't decided whether to call the legislature back into special session after some key bills failed to pass on Sunday night. Public Works bonding bill and a transportation funding plan were left undone. On transportation, Dayton says he's doubtful that after more than a year of work on the issue, that lawmakers could reach agreement in a special session.
Everybody knew what the situation was. Everybody agreed that it required $600 million a year in new revenue each year for 10 years to do what needs to be done to improve Minnesota's highway and transit systems. And they couldn't agree on it during that period of time. I think it's unrealistic to think they're going to agree on something before or during a very, short one-day special session, if there were one.
Dayton said it's more likely a bonding bill would be a focus of a special session if he decides to call one. A package of subsidies designed to lure a wood siding manufacturer to the Iron Range was included in bills that passed the legislature in the closing hours, Dan Crocker reports.
Lawmakers have still not identified the company, which they say would create 250 permanent jobs and jobs for loggers and truckers. The subsidies include a production incentive of up to $3 million a year, a sales tax exemption for materials used to build the plant, and $10 million to help pay for related infrastructure. Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board Commissioner Mark Phillips says the incentives are needed to compete with other states and Canada.
You know, we're not that unique as far as wood resources. So if you want to compete with other states and with other countries, you're going to probably play in this game.
The legislature also included funding for the DNR to hire more foresters to make more timber available to be cut. Governor Dayton has not yet signed the bills. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
The Minneapolis School Board has chosen Anchorage Superintendent Ed Graff as the district's new leader. The board picked Graff over Minnesota Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius in a 6-3 vote last night. The district has gone through two superintendent searches over a year and a half, and the process has been contentious at times. Last night, board members called for unity. Solveig Wastfedt has more.
The Minneapolis School Board didn't try to hide the fact. Ed Graff will have his work cut out for him in Minneapolis.
I believe that his calm demeanor is something that is great for a politically charged, drama-filled, theatrical stage that we're often in.
Board member Josh Reimnitz spoke in support of Graff ahead of the board's vote to begin contract negotiations with the Anchorage School District leader. Graff is originally from Bemidji, Minnesota, but has lived in Alaska since 1987. He joined Anchorage Schools in 1991. Reimnitz noted Graff's recent experience maintaining staff morale during staff and budget cuts in Anchorage.
That gives me hope that we could turn around the toxic culture that I've seen in the Davis Center, and that extends beyond out from there.
The superintendent search has divided the Minneapolis district since Bernadia Johnson suddenly announced she was stepping down for personal reasons in December 2014. The district cut off talks with its top candidate in January over abuse allegations at a school in that candidate's former district. Critics of the search shut down a January board meeting and forced the board to restart the search. Board Chair Jenny Arneson said she hopes Graff's skill communicating with students and staff can restore morale.
Really, my sense from him is that it's about the people, not the programs. That's what I got from him.
Graff promised to get straight to work in a Skype call after the vote.
The urgency is the common thread that I've heard from all my interactions and discussions. And that urgency really is about creating opportunities for our kids, positive opportunities.
Graff said he aims to arrive in Minneapolis in June and has started looking for a place to live in the area. But in discussion prior to the vote, several board members were concerned that Graff will have trouble hitting the ground running. Anchorage's student population is much different than that in Minneapolis. Anchorage has large populations of Asian and Pacific Islander and multiracial students, but it has far fewer Black students. Minneapolis's academic achievement gap between students of color and white students is one of the district's biggest challenges. Board member Syed Ali voted for Brenda Caselius in part because of her local experience.
I myself feel that we miss a great opportunity, but I do respect the decisions that we made here. I hope he addresses some of these issues. I hope that African-American communities that work with the new superintendent and give him opportunity that he can work and do his job.
A lot of conversations start from how someone looks.
Graf addressed the concern with one of the main themes of his board interview last week, a focus on students.
And who I am is that I look at every student as an individual and listen first and make sure I understand their story. And I think that's how you develop those relationships and connections and how you build trust and success.
Even board members who disagreed with the vote outcome called on the board to unite behind the new leader. Board member Tracine Asbury made that same plea to the parents and community members who filled the room to watch the vote.
We have to wrap our arms around this leader. One person is not going to change the system. There's a reason why the system still exists that does not allow our Black kids to thrive, our Native kids to thrive, our Latino kids to thrive. And I think that that's the thing that we haven't really accepted. It is us.
The board aims to vote on a contract with Graf Friday and start his term as superintendent in July. The board appointed District Chief of Schools Michael Thomas as a second interim leader to serve after the current interim Michael Gore leaves the district June 1st. Covering education, I'm Solveig Wastvedt, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Today marks the last day victims of child sexual abuse in Minnesota can file claims for incidents that occurred decades ago. Since the legislature passed the Child Victims Act 3 years ago, hundreds of cases have been filed that once would have been barred by the statute of limitations. Todd Melby reports on the law's history and impact.
As a kid, John Landstrom spent hours in the pool, churning out lap after lap. His dedication paid off, winning him a spot on the Roseville Stingrays, an AAU swim team. But an encounter with an assistant swim coach would change how he felt about going to the pool.
He wanted to have his hands on me. Even if it was in front of people, he wanted to pet me or have his hands on me.
Landstrom says the inappropriate behavior escalated until one day the coach sexually molested him. This was the 1970s, and Landstrom was just 12 years old. He says he was scared and didn't know who to tell about what was going on. So he kept quiet.
For years, I thought I was protecting people by keeping this a secret, and I paid a real price for it.
Eventually, Landstrom went to therapy, and he began talking about his traumatic experiences with his family. In 2012, he called a lawyer, but the attorney said he couldn't help.
Forever, I kept hearing, yeah, your statutes of limitations have expired, you have no recourse.
It was true. For years, victims of childhood sexual abuse had little recourse in Minnesota courts. The statute of limitations for suing alleged perpetrators was short. In 1989, Minnesota passed a delayed discovery law that gave victims 6 years from the time of adult awareness of past abuse to file suit. In 1996, the Minnesota Supreme Court interpreted that to mean 6 years after becoming an adult, that is, age 24. Since many victims don't come to terms with childhood sexual abuse until decades later, legal action was rarely an option. But not long after John Landstrom visited that attorney who told him he didn't have a case, things would change. Not just for him, but for hundreds of others. In 2013, the legislature passed the Child Victims Act. The new law lifted the statute of limitations for incidents of child sexual abuse that occurred after the law took effect, and it gave past victims 3 years to sue abusers and the organizations that employed them or directed their volunteer activities. In 2013, Secretary of State Steve Simon was a state representative and chief sponsor of the Child Victims Act.
It was wrong to close the courthouse doors and deny them a day in court to even make an accusation about something that happened to them that shaped the course and trajectory of their lives. It was wrong.
But the near-unanimous approval for the act masked a tough fight in the years before its passage. In 2007, Simon began working on a bill that would eventually become the Child Victims Act. After talking to victims and studying case law, he became convinced of the need for change.
This is an area where there's a tremendous stigma attached, where the victims, the survivors of childhood sex abuse, feel all sorts of feelings, shame, guilt.
But during three consecutive legislative sessions, Simon's bill died in committee around the House floor. But once it did pass, it didn't take long for victims to start coming forward. John Doe 1 filed a lawsuit just a few weeks later, alleging abuse at the hands of a Catholic priest. That case was eventually settled. And in the 3 years since, more than 900 victims have sought damages for incidents that would have been barred under the old law. Attorney Jeff Anderson filed that first case under the act and hundreds more that followed. He says the impact has been sweeping.
There have been resignations. There have been prosecutions. There has been a kind of a public shaming, and that has increased public awareness, and that has increased institutional awareness. So yes, every day, every single day, I believe we are seeing change.
In addition to the AAU, suits have been filed against the Children's Theater Company and the Boy Scouts. But the majority have been filed against the Catholic Church, more than 400 alone against the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and more than 100 against the Duluth Diocese. Clergy abuse claims eventually forced the Twin Cities Archdiocese into bankruptcy. It's been selling off assets to help pay off claims likely to reach millions of dollars. There has been significant upheaval in church leadership, including the resignation of Archbishop John Nystedt. And the church has vowed to change. In October 2014, victims' attorney Anderson held a joint news conference with church officials to announce a series of steps to bring more transparency to church handling of clergy abuse. Auxiliary Bishop Andrew Cousins represented the church at that news conference.
What we're doing is not about a publicity stunt, not about a slogan, but it's about a deep desire to bring healing. And I hope that you're going to see that not just in our words, but in our actions.
David Clossy of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests remains skeptical.
I believe it's been change for show, change due to external pressure. And I believe, quite frankly, to assume otherwise is to be dreadfully naive and reckless.
Gene Ronayne is the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She says, whatever the impact on institutions, the law has been good for victims.
They've borne the impact of what happened to them for decades, and their life took a course that was a totally different trajectory because of what happened to them. And so someone really needs to be held accountable to that.
But Ronayne says the act could have been stronger.
I think the bill could have definitely, you know, gone farther and could have kept it open. No statute of limitations ever.
Steve Simon doesn't disagree with Ronayne, but he says he didn't have the votes for a longer window. He says the three-year limit was a compromise with a high payoff.
What we got in return for that was that going forward, for all incidents of childhood sex abuse going forward, from the day of enactment afterwards, there will be no statute of limitations of any kind.
State Representative Steve Drazkowski, a Republican from Mazeppa, was one of seven House members who opposed the bill in 2013. 3 years later, he's still not a fan.
We're looking at 30 years later. I can't even remember what I did 3 years ago, more or less 30 years ago. I just don't think this is good policy. It certainly was brought by the trial attorneys, and they have made a lot of hay on this so far.
Lawyers representing victims will likely make millions off their cases. But for people like John Landstrom, the swimmer who says he was abused back in the 70s, the Child Victims Act has brought the chance for long-needed closure. For NPR News, I'm Todd Milby.
And that's your Polycast for this Wednesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. I'm going to be off for a couple days, so the Polycast will be back again on Tuesday, and we'll see you then.